My name is Velma Allen. I'm 79 years old. Today's date is October 16th, 2019. I am in Lansing, Michigan, and my relationship to my partner is friend.
And I am J.J. Jackson, and I'm 69 years old. I hate to say that. And I am here in Lansing, Michigan, proud on October 16th to be here with my dear friend and colleague at times, and a person that I have admired, Velma Allen. And I would like to say that it is my pleasure and honor to say a few words about Velma so you as the audience can know the background of these of both of us. Dr. Velma Perkins Allen received degrees from Michigan State University, her PhD, Mississippi State University, where she achieved her master's, Mississippi Valley State, her bachelor's, and Dr. Allen studied English at the University of Iowa and Kansas State. She has been an English teacher, special education director, superintendent of the Michigan School for the Blind, which is where we became connected, program officer for the Mott Foundation, and president and CEO of Mott Children's Health Center during her 50-year career. Velma, I will call you that, is also a singer, a songwriter, a record producer, and author. And I'll let her tell you a little bit about her recent book that she has. But Dr. Velma Allen currently resides in Flint, Michigan. Her biography and links to her CDs are available on her website. V as in voice, E-E-A-L-L-E-N, so that's vallen.com. And Velma, I'm so happy to be here with you. And today we're going to share stories about the Michigan School for the Blind, which brought us together. But I am associated with the School for the Blind in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and Velma will cover the 80s and 90s, I believe. So,
absolutely. Thank you, J.J. Let me say that J.J. is the illustrious person here today who has the information and experience regarding the Michigan School for the Blind that is so relevant to what we're going to talk about today. J.J. graduated from the Michigan School for the Blind as its first African-American valedictorian. And then he went on to work at General Motors in Lansing. He went on from there to spend some time with his best friend, still today his best friend, Stevie Wonder, out in Los Angeles, trying to help Stevie with his organization, with the business end, and also some other personal assistance that he was able to provide. Then he went on to Michigan State University to handle the Office of Handicapper Affairs, where he worked with a number of individuals, helping them to get the most out of their college experience at MSU. Then finally, I think his last out-of-state experience might have been the Amoco Oil Company when he worked in Chicago with Amoco for many years. He served on the Michigan Commission for the Blind. He does all kinds of volunteer work with the United Cerebral Palsy Organization, where he's going to receive an award coming up, I think, next weekend. And he's also worked with other volunteer organizations in the Lansing area. I think he's going to get an award from the Tri-City. Is it the Tri-City Volunteer Organization, J.J.?
Yes.
In the next few days, Volunteer of the Month, I believe. So J.J. is truly an illustrious person who's done so much work on behalf of the blind community. And I am honored indeed to be here with J.J. and delighted that he invited me to join him for this recording.
Thank you, Velma, so much. And you said so many kind things. I'm turning red, and you can't see that on the recording, but I am blushing. Let's talk about the School for the Blind. You know, I was born with sight, But at age 5, I went blind. I was just about to start public school, kindergarten, and I became blind, so I had to switch to join the Michigan School for the Blind, which had been open and serving Michigan students since around 1900. It had seen many evolutions during that period of time, but when I started there, kindergarten, and I went all the way through 12th grade, it was a campus that served students throughout the state of Michigan. So you might have students from the Upper Peninsula there. You might have students from Lansing, from Detroit, all around the state. And so they had a dormitory life situation. And I, my family lived in Lansing, just about 10 blocks from the school. So I was the kind of student that came in the morning and left in the late afternoon. And so we called us day students as opposed to those who lived in the dormitory. Now, the dormitory life for the students was very key and crucial in terms of developing independence as blind people, and turning sort of just learning to sort out your clothing and have some sense of what you were wearing. We had to adjust to fixing our own breakfast, that kind of thing. And so those are life skills that a lot of sighted students take for granted that were taught and incorporated into the day-to-day program in addition to the academic education. I have a friend, for example, who was learning to put hair cream in his hair, and one morning he did that and got to class and discovered he had put Crest toothpaste in his hair instead, and he had to go back to the dorm and wash that out. So there were learning experiences as a blind person day to day. But let me talk up for a moment about the academic program, if that's all right, Thelma.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
We had a teaching staff at the School for the Blind of about 35 teachers, and perhaps 6 of those teachers were blind. One of the things that we were taught was Braille, and I discovered as a surprise that the sighted teachers of the blind read Braille with their eyesight. They could not develop the sensitivity in their fingers like the blind students were required to do. And so the teachers would grade our homework, which would be in Braille, but they'd read using their sight to read the dots. We had all the classes that anyone would have in a public school as well. My favorite class was mathematics, for example, and chemistry, and those kind of classes. But in addition, we had the opportunities to explore music. We had music classes where you'd learn to sing together and develop your rhythm patterns. But then we could learn a particular instrument and join a band. Now, the School for the Blind Band had won many awards. And one of the major differences I should point out is that as a band of blind students, we could not read the music score while we're playing our instruments. So we had to read it in Braille separate in practice and then come together as a band and play our parts. Now, interestingly enough, our band director himself was blind, Mr. Jack Chard, and I admired Mr. Chard greatly because he was a role model for us. He not only directed the band and taught each person their instrument to play, but he also arranged for this band to travel throughout the state of Michigan and to other states as well as ambassadors. And we would go to, for example, Houghton Lake is a town in Michigan, or we'd go to Traverse City. And Mr. Chard would arrange at each one of these cities with the Lions Club to host in their homes two or three blind students to live with them for that day that we were in Traverse City. Then the same thing would occur at the next city. It gave us a chance to socialize away from our home, to learn to live and fit into a normal society, a regular society. And we developed, I liked the band because I developed skills. Well, I should say this. I was an introvert and very shy. And traveling with the band allowed me to get to know people and to come out of my shell, so to speak. In fact, I started doing comedy in the band and started doing Flip Wilson episodes and those kind of things. And I began to become known when they would introduce us in a new city. They'd say, and J.J. Jackson, a comedian, is with the band. So the band was about more than playing music, but we would demonstrate mental mathematics skills where you would speak a whole lot of sequence of calculations real rapidly, and then the student has to follow that mentally and shout out the answer at the end of about 10 mathematical computations. Mr. Chard, I said, was a role model, and he forever will be in my mind in terms of developing me and others into adults that we are today. In talking about the school in the 50s and 60s, there were 300 students there, kindergarten through 12th grade. And in my third grade year, my brother Milton became blind, and he joined the school for the blind. So there were two of us there. And it was interesting to experience that with a family member that I could count on to help me out in tough situations. I should say that the School for the Blind here in Michigan, among the 300 students, only 9 of them were African-American students. And that posed some problems when you have a living community of dormitory students. Oh, about 220 of them were living in the dorm, and the other 80 were day students. But they cohabitated. They socialized together. And there were times in the difficult civil rights times of the 60s and racial unrest across the country. We experienced that at the School for the Blind. Now, you might say to yourself, why would race come into play when you've got blind students? Students who don't see the color of their neighbor's skin. And Velma, I'd like your reflection on this in a moment, but let me say my take on that was the students, even though they couldn't see what color you were, they learned from their parents and family and from their upbringing who was black and how to feel about them, who to dislike, who to stay away from, who to put down. And I remember when Stevie Wonder became a star and joined the School for the Blind in eighth grade, because the Detroit school system refused to educate him. They said, you have to make a choice. Either you're a star or you're a student. Well, the School for the Blind in Lansing said, no, you don't have to make that choice. We can make arrangements where you'll have a private tutor travel with you when you're on tour for Motown. And that tutor would teach you your homework, your education, give you exams while on the road. When you come back to school, you'd be right in line, Stevie, with your classmates. But I remember when Stevie first came to the school, people did not know if he was black or white. And so you'd find this scenario. You'd find a white student sitting next to Steve, and we're pretty touchy as blind people, so we touch each other, and that student would place his hand on Stevie's arm and then creep up to his shoulder. and then eventually to his side of his head. And I remember one student said, "Oh, Steve, I didn't know you had soul hair." And that was the comment. But they wanted to know, are you black? And therefore they put you in a pigeonhole because they had been taught that from their home. Now, have you experienced things like this in your past, Thelma?
Well, you know, I grew up in the Deep South. So, you know, those kinds of feelings and the questions and all of that were always prevalent. But I remember when I was a little girl, I thought that I saw some white girls doing the split. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't do the split because you have to be white to jump up and come down like that. But, I mean, when we're young, we don't know what to make of it. You know, we know some people look different and act different and can do different things. But we learn that. It's all learned behavior from our you know, friends and families and parents. Yes. And I think it's no different at the school. I'm sure kids were told, given instructions about who to watch out for, who to play with or who not to play with back in the day, you know, back when you were there. When I was the superintendent, we didn't have too many issues of that sort. I don't remember anybody bringing any issues to me around race or the children having problems. I mean, children were aware of who was white and who was not white, but I don't remember it being a particular issue. But I think children are just naturally curious, and I think that's probably part of it. But there was the other part, too, back when you were there, that you have probably had to contend with.
You know, being a campus situation and dormitories and kids living there, some kids would go home every two weekends, every other weekend. Some were there from September till Thanksgiving. And then again, they'd have a break-in at Christmas time. So, but it was a living situation 24/7. And so the administration of the school was responsible for the students' growth and responsible to the parents as well. And so, unfortunately, in the 60s, the School for the Blind took a posture of keeping the blacks and white students separate socially. That is, they were not allowed to date one another. And if you did date, meaning if you went to roller skating one evening or if you went bowling with a white girl and you were seen with a white girl, the school would separate you. Unfortunately, they had that attitude until some of the African-American students and African-American staff got together and reported it to the NAACP, who contacted the school and said, "You are a state-funded agency, organization, and also federal funding, and there's no rules in our state government that say keep blacks and whites separate." And that made the school administration take note and have to adjust their policies to match the state government. I want to talk just for a moment about, because you were superintendent in the 80s and 90s. Before that, I think around 1957, Dr. Robert Thompson was our superintendent. And Dr. Thompson had come from St. Louis School for the Blind, and he had a lot of innovative ideas around the school. So he immediately had built a new gymnasium, which was regular gymnasium size. He even put a basketball hoop at each end of that gym, and he put a device on the backboard of the basket that clicked like that. And we as blind people therefore could aim toward that sound and learn to shoot baskets. Another thing he did in the gymnasium was to put speakers in all the four corners of the gym. And we were taught to put on roller skates and the roller skate to music. They'd have the music playing and you would hear the speaker, let's say, in the right-hand corner. So you'd roller skate toward that, And you could tell when by the sound when you were getting 15 feet, 20 feet away from it. So you'd turn left toward the left corner speaker, and you'd navigate the whole gym roller skating like that around and knowing where you were in the gymnasium. Dr. Thompson also built, as a part of that gym, an indoor swimming pool, and we were all taught swimming, which I shall say later on in adulthood, I was fortunate to win some gold medals in adult swimming for blind nationally. So, but it's because of those experiences at the school. They had a three-lane bowling alley, and we were taught to bowl as well as taught to set pins for our other student pals. And so I would never have learned to bowl if I had not had the experience at the School for the Blind. Our math teacher, and math is a very visual concept, and our math teacher was blind himself, and so he was an inspiration for me. He taught us mental arithmetic. He said that as blind people, you can't pick up a pencil or a pen and write down figures and doing them visually. So you have to depend on your memory. So he tested us or challenged us with who can do the fastest computation in your head. And as a blind person, role modeling like that, that's why I went to Michigan State University and my bachelor's was in mathematics. And primarily because of Mr. Newman, Fred Newman. What have I left out here?
Did you experience Camp T while you were there?
I did. Yeah. In fact, the School for the Blind bought the property, I think it's 300 acres, on the west side of the state near Grand Rapids. And some of the teachers and staff, along with the Boy Scout groups, went up to this property and built the first cabins on the property. So the blind students had that experience under sighted supervision, how to construct a building that they then lived in. And they built the dock because there was a lake there that we could swim off of or take little paddle boats off of. And so it was. I thought it was really neat that they included the blind students in the construction of the facilities rather than just having it erected and having us come up there. That camp is still in operations. In the summer, they still run programs. And later in my life, when I became a coordinator of services at Michigan State University for students with disabilities, I established a support group for the blind, and one of our major activities was to go up to that Camp T, they called it. I will say the real name was Camp Tush Mahita, and it sounds like a Native American name, but it's actually a combination of touch, hearing, smell, and taste, the senses that we blind people use. So they put that together and came up with Tush Mahita. I was saying at Michigan State University, I took the support group for the blind up to that camp, and we would learn how to fix meals ourselves, how to go down to the lake and swim, and orient ourselves in the trails. It was just a great experience all around. You had something to do with Camp T.
Well, you know, Dr. T, the superintendent that you mentioned earlier, I think he was the person who was instrumental in getting all that set up. And I think it was privately endowed, too. I think it had a funding base to keep it going. But, you know, if we want to segue into when I ended up at the school, when I went there in 1984, things were drastically different than they were when you were there. I wish I had experienced the school in its heyday. But by the time I arrived, the population had dwindled significantly, and the cost was astronomical, is what I was reminded of on a regular basis by the Department of Management and Budget and others at the State Department of Education. But the cost made it prohibitive for a lot of districts to send students there because the charges were billed back to those local districts. And also, we had a new law in Michigan, a Public Act 198, which required that all children be educated in the least restrictive environment. And for a lot of people, that meant, well, they had to go to a regular school down the street with all the other kids. I thought the least restrictive meant the environment that would be least restrictive or more supportive of the student's needs and would provide for that student to develop and grow. But a lot of people interpreted that to mean you had to be in regular education and there had to be a significant reason to bring you out of the regular ed classroom. So people were fighting for children to have access to regular education classrooms, which was understandable. But by the same token, they were having trouble justifying having children go away to essentially a boarding school for blind children. And they saw that as the most restrictive. As a matter of fact, I think in some classes I was taught, now that's the most restrictive. You know, all the way to regular ed placement, that's the least restrictive. So given that, the drop-off in the enrollment and the astronomical costs of sending people there, we were down to, I think, 60 or 70 students when I was there. And programs were curtailed significantly. So it was just a totally different kind of experience for me as a superintendent.
And were the students under you? Did they have multiple disabilities?
Excuse me, I was trying to signal the coughing spell.
That's okay. Just...
Okay, hold on. See if I can make it go away. I knew it was going to happen at some point. I just didn't know what it should know. I'm coughing into my shirt, JJ. So
oh, that's fine.
Not flying over to you.
Would you like a Mentol? A Mentol?
No, I think I'm maybe good for another few minutes. But I think I was just saying things had changed. Do you remember what I was saying? Things had changed dramatically when I
And I was asking you, were they still multiply impaired when you were there?
Yes.
Which is a difference because when I was there in the 50s, 60s, 70s, blindness was their only disability out of the 300 there. So they were levels of blindness.
Absolutely. We had a deaf-blind population, and we had students who were severely multiply impaired, so we had several levels of children, you know, with levels of disabilities there. But I guess the biggest problem was the lack of support and the lack of financing to add programs and to keep the school afloat. Sorry. We wondered about closure, and especially when the Department of Corrections placed its training program on our campus and the old Lions Hall, the major, I guess, the sort of the centerpiece of the campus. The Department of Corrections started training individuals there. And then we had a daycare center open up, and it looked like closure for us was going to be imminent. And we had to worry about that. And even though we were able to start some new programs, summer programs to get children to come back, and we got Camp T going again, but it was not enough to stave off the, you know, the efforts of the powers that be to look for ways to get children back in the local districts and also to save significant money for the state instead of operating the school. So, excuse me. You were going to ask something else about the time, JJ, that I was there.
Yes. What would you say were your major challenges? And you mentioned the cost. And let me just for a minute make sure we state clearly. The least restrictive environment law was utilized for local school districts to keep the money for serving those blind students in their counties or in their school district.
That's true.
And rather than sending that money to a special school for the blind, for example, and letting the school for the blind have that money to educate the blind students. They wanted that money in the public schools, of course.
Well, that's true. And they were billed back for those charges.
Yes.
And, you know, the smaller the population got, the more expensive it became for children to be housed at the school in the residential program.
You know, I was surprised, Velma. I mean, there's always things you can learn in this world. And since I was a day student and did not live in the dormitory, I did live in my sophomore year only, but that was the only year I lived on campus. There were some things that I wasn't keyed into, and one I learned recently that one of the blind students from Western Michigan who came to, and he stayed in the dormitory, he really resented his parents from taking him out of his home and to this strange place and just dropping him off and leaving him there. And he developed a lot of anger and hostility around feeling like his parents were dumping him off somewhere. That hadn't occurred to me as a possibility for students to react that way. Another thing I learned is there was a woman who lost some vision in 7th, 8th grade level. So she suddenly came to the school of the blind. She had always been in a public school where learning was a visual medium. And now suddenly she was in the school for the blind where our learning was taught auditorily. And so it was a big adjustment to her to learn to learn through your ears and educational. And so I had never thought of that as an obstacle or a challenge for some students to suddenly adapt to being taught auditorily. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the whole concept of least restrictive environment, I'm sure many kids probably did not appreciate having to leave the neighborhood to go away to a boarding school. And I used to try to think of a way to present the school as an option that didn't have to be a full year option for everybody. It could just be a summer school program for some kids. It could be a semester for some kids. But if we could take a look at what's available locally and then see what was missing, so if the children needed to go away to the school for the blind for some special program or some special workshop or activity, we could provide that. It didn't have to be all or nothing. And somehow we were just never able to communicate that, to the extent that we wanted to. We did get a few kids who would come for summer school, which was quite nice. They could come and brush up on some of the skills of blindness, the orientation and mobility classes that they might not have locally, and to also socialize with other blind children. So that helped to some extent. But we never got the semester or the quarter system going. Like at a university, you go for a term and you work on something and you go, you can go back home. I often thought if we could have gotten that accepted statewide, it might have had a lot to do with helping the school keep a place, you know, in the continuum of education for children.
You know, that brings to mind for me the concept that I feel I came around at the perfect time for my educational opportunities. I needed and I saw the value of a community campus where we could compete with each other as blind people, whether it's musically or sports or whatever the reason. We could compete and feel like we could be a champion. Whereas if I had been grown up in a totally public school setting, I never probably would have been able to play the saxophone like I do. I certainly wouldn't have been captain of the football team or a basketball team. So at a school for the blind, which specialized in that education, it allowed me to find my own level of independence and confidence. And that enabled me, therefore, to go out confidently into the public world and enter college and compete and feel like I had something to contribute. MSU, Michigan State University, was a great opportunity for me to learn more about the world. But without the base I received at the School for the Blind, in terms of the skills and how to adapt my skills. And adapt is the key word, how to use my senses to adapt and do the same thing my sighted peers were doing. And that's what the school was all about. They weren't about pampering us or letting us escape work. They were about, you are blind, but you are a person, and you will learn to do this. We had shop classes, I forget, learning to make use tools, saws, electric saws and drills, and things like that, and yet work with them safely and build things out of wood or out of metal, or we built transistor radios. Those kind of experiences pay off in the long run. And I feel bad that blind students who are in public schools all their life may have missed some things that specialized teaching might have given them the skills to do. For example, math is not easily taught in public schools to blind students, because even when I went to Michigan State and got my degree in math, I had to conquer the fact that most of the math teachers in college wrote on the blackboard, wrote on the overhead transparency, and I couldn't see the equations. And so it was a real challenge. But I was glad that you came along when you did in the 80s. I think the school really needed someone with your background and your perspective as an administrator to guide them through those tough waters.
Well, you know, I wish I could have done more. And I have to thank you so much for endorsing me. When I showed up there, I met you right away, and you came on to my advisory committee. And I think you helped to open doors for me to the blind community and gave me some credibility that I didn't have as the superintendent, even though I had been trained in special education administration. I had very limited experience working in the field of blindness. But, you know, through your involvement and your giving me advice, and people like Fred Wurzel and Mary Wurzel and others who took me under their wing and said, okay, we'll help you with what you don't know. If you listen, we can help. I think you provided a lot of support for me. I wish I had been able to do more to keep the door open. I remember after you introduced me to Stevie, he said, well, what can I do to help the school? And I said, I don't know how to ask you to help the school, because I think it's the state's responsibility to support the school. And I don't believe it should be you should feel that you should have to come back and provide money to keep the doors open at the school. I just don't know how to do that. He said, of course, well, if I want to, I will. I said, well, sure you will. You know, but I'm not going to be the one to suggest that to you. I think the state needs to commit to keeping the school, you know, and having it become whatever it needs to be for today, even though it may not be the same MSB that it was many, many years ago in its heyday.
But, you know, when I introduced you to Stevie, it was the occasion of a 100-year historical marker being placed at the School for the Blind.
Yes.
And I also was excited because you're a songwriter, you're a singer yourself, you have some CDs out. Do you mind giving yourself a plug about the book title that you just wrote?
Well, what I'll say is this. I wrote a memoir, and it's about my brothers, who are all musicians, and my mother, who was a very strong woman. However, there is a chapter in my book about J.J. and Stevie. So that just shows you how significant you guys were and you still are in my life. And I think meeting Stevie and being with you and Steve and being friends and talking about all the things we talked about, the MSB, I think it was certainly a highlight of my life and my career.
I thank you for mentioning us in the book. And I'm in the process of writing my book, too, which is called The Rings of Friendship. And
yes.
It's about many of the stories of Stevie and I growing up together. For example, when I went out to Michigan State University and living in the dorms there, he would come from Detroit and stay over the weekend in the dorm, and we'd jam and have a party, and the life was fun. But I want to end with some humorous kind of reflections about the School for the Blind, and on a positive note.
Yes.
Many people think that blind folks don't have any fun. What a dark world, and they can't do anything. Folks let their own lack of knowledge about a situation color their vision of what we can and cannot do. But I want to say that blind students were like any other students. We had the same wants and the desires, and you know, we had fun. We pulled pranks on each other. There was a friend of mine named Al Swain there who won. There was a fountain in front of the school library. And at one Saturday, Al took a huge box of Tide laundry detergent, the powder kind, poured it in the fountain, and he just loved to see the wind blowing the suds, the bubbles, all across the lawn. Or there were people, time like Stevie, and I got to tell this story. Stevie Wonder had a sweet tooth, and he still does. And he lived in the dormitory for a while. And at 10 o'clock, lights were out. Well, once the lights were out, he'd take the screen off his window, and he'd climb out, and he'd go across the street to the little store and buy some pop and candy and cookies. Well, one night, when he's coming back from the store, you find the corner of the building, and then you count the windows. And he counted the wrong window number, and he climbed in some other students' bedroom window, and they were hollering and shouting. And so Steve had to quiet them down and get out of there.
So, I'm sure there were many fun days like that with you and Steve and other friends at MSB.
That really were. It was a great place to grow up. Should we keep going? Is it done?
Can we ask questions now?
Yeah.
Okay.
We've got about a minute.
Oh, well, if you want to keep on going, and then I'll ask questions.
No.
So, question for you, JJ. I love the stories you told about Al and Stevie. Do you remember any particular story with any of those teachers who you said were inspirations, and like something mm-hmm. they said, or you know, something like about the way they spoke, their voice, something in particular that you know, kind of set you on your way? Do you remember anything about any of them?
Well, I do. In fact, my math teacher who was blind, Mr. Fred Newman. He always called me the king because I routinely, I guess, came up with the answer before everyone else. So he'd say, that chair is for the king. And he made me feel special. And I think that was an influence on me. But Jack Tarr, the band director, I've mentioned many times. In 1966, for example, Michigan State University had a summer music program from students all over the country, 50 states would come to participate. And in 66, Jack Chard got the first group of students from the School for the Blind to join in that participation. And we had summer music camp at Michigan State. And we played in bands, of course, that were predominantly sighted folks. We were the only blind students in them. And it's through innovative efforts like that to showcase blind folks and to expose us to the world and the world to us that helped us to grow. I'll never forget a band. We were up northern Michigan performing in it was a small town, and I said we stayed in the homes of local people when we performed there. And one night I'm sitting at the home of this family, and they had a 5-year-old daughter, and all of a sudden she said what the parents didn't want to hear. She said to me, she said, "You're an African, aren't you?" She said, "I know, I can tell, because I've seen some of you on TV." And her parents were stunned, like they didn't know what to say. And really, as a 16-year-old, I was kind of surprised, but I said, "Well, yes, you're right. I am an African." But things like that occur, and it's a learning situation. Does that help you?
Absolutely. And I have, if I may, a question for it. Those are great stories.
Yeah.
I always say 40 minutes isn't enough. For you, Velma, were you at MSB when it closed?
No, I left about 5 years before it closed. Mm-hmm. But it was obvious to me that that was mm-hmm. the direction that it was going in after we had those other programs moving in. And you know, we failed to launch this specialized kind of quarter deal where kids would come for periods of time for services and then go back home. But I could see the handwriting on the wall. The numbers yes. just were not increasing. So I left about 5 years before. Then they had one other person come in after me for a while. And I don't know if he was ever named superintendent. He might have been acting. But pretty quickly, you know, it closed. And I think the services for the blind are now on the campus of the School for the Deaf in Flint, Michigan. They also have services for children with visually impaired there too. And I don't know the status of those services or who's really served or what, you know, what kinds of children with disabilities. But anyway, I was there for the ending.
Was there one story, one student that sticks in your mind, or something that you feel that you were happy in accomplishing while you were there?
You know, for a while, I remember when I was introduced to the student body in the library, and I told them, said, "I'm going to try to get kids to come back. We're going to have more students. We're going to have more programs." They were so excited, and they would see me in the hallway, and they said, "Dr. Allen, are there more students coming yet? You know, how's it going?" You know, like a week or two later, they'd ask me again. So for a while, you know, things perked up a bit. I was there for 6 years. So things perked up a bit, and we got more involved with local special education directors, and I tried to explain what we could do and make it easier for them to access our services. But when they, you know, the handwriting just became more obvious on the wall and the other programs moved in, as I said, I could see that it just wasn't going to go anywhere. Then the unions, we had grievances filed over various things, and it just was not a pleasant place after a while, and I could see that it wasn't going to go. But the kids were beautiful. I really just enjoyed being with them, and they were so capable. Many of them had other disabilities, but I mean, they got around the campus, they socialized, they interacted with one another and with, you know, friends and visitors. It was a great place to be, and the kids were great. It was great.